Good morning, everyone. My name is Todd Cochran, and you are watching the Saturday Morning Tech Show. And I want to welcome you to the show. We're live streaming on live.geeknewscentral.com or over at geeknewscentral.com. We're not up on Ustream or Justin this morning. We'll talk a little bit about that here in a second. But I want to welcome Rob Greenlee on the bottom and Chase Nunes on the top. Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good morning, fellas.
Good.
Great to be here.
Good morning. Yeah. How's it going?
It's going good, and you guys sound like you're right, like sitting right next to me. So it's a beautiful thing. For those of you that aren't familiar with Chase, I'm going to bring up his website here. He is a content creator over at Tech Podcast, and he does a show. Let me see if we can get this. There we go. He does a show called Geek Gamer Radio. And what do you guys do? Do you guys do a show once a week or twice a week, or often do you do a show, Chase?
Well, the URL is Geek Gamer Radio, but we do a show called Geek Gamer Weekly. Uh-huh. And the show, we do it live Sunday nights, usually around 9 p.m. Pacific. We've been trying to do it a little bit early lately. We talk about the latest in technology, so some of the top news, you know, in regards to, say, you know, bandwidth caps or gadgets, that sort of thing. But we also speak about the top gaming news. You know, we're all awesome gamers. We love to game. And so we will talk about that as well. We will talk, you know, consoles, PC gaming, board gaming, really anything related to gaming. We will talk about that as well.
Very, very cool. So everyone make sure you get over to geekgamerradio.com and check out Chase's show. And of course, Rob, you are, I guess, you know, not only are you at Rob Greenlee, but you are also one of the primary supporters behind Zune Insider. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, your about Zune Insider and your relationship over there.
Well, we just launched a new version of the Zune Insider blog here just this past week, and it's a total kind of remodel of the whole site, and we're starting to do more video, and we're starting to do, you know, it's built on a WordPress platform. So we spent many years on kind of a, you know, a Microsoft community server platform.
Right.
And then I've been pushing for actually multiple years for us to migrate to what you see today. And I've been able to successfully push it through. And what's really interesting about it is it's being really run by our social media team. So, you know, it's the same team that does the Zune on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and so it's really socially enabled. It's really kind of creating a synergy effect across, our social media platform. It gives them a place to post more in depth, larger posts, more in depth posts about things that are going on at Zune, and then I can also use it as a place that I can embed video now, or the old platform I couldn't do any embedded of video for years. So what you're seeing here is actually a new episode of the show that just came out yesterday, and I actually brought in a little handheld HD camera and filmed them actually doing the show in the studio for about half of the show. So, and then I also run the podcast catalog for the Zune Marketplace experience. So.
Well, I like the website design. It's nice and clean, and it's pretty.
And it's pretty.
Yeah, it is.
Well,
it's pretty.
That's what I was shooting for. That's right.
Well, it is. It looks nice. So, for those of you that are new to the stream here, of course, you can find Geek News Central, of course, at geeknewscentral.com. And one thing that I'm really promoting right now is our new live site. So when I'm live, you can come over to live.geeknewscentral.com. And the live site basically gives you the ability to watch the content. And then, of course, participate in the chat room. You just got to log in. And that'll get you dialed into the actual live site and all the stuff there to subscribe to the show. Let me talk just a little bit about where the changes come in on using Ustream and Justin. Earlier this week, the folks at Amazon And let me see if I can actually find the page and bring it up for you so you can see it. Amazon announced that they were making, as part of their Amazon Web Services, that they were going to, that they're going to, that they actually introduced a new service called, it's with the Amazon CloudFront. They've introduced the ability to run Adobe Flash Media Server, which, and not only just Adobe Flash Media Server, but Adobe Flash Media Server Enterprise, and all for the low price of $5 a month to actually license the streaming service. And then what they do is they just basically tie it into EC2 and some of their other bucket stuff. And what you end up with, once you go through about, took about an hour for me to set this up. The hardest part was getting the actual domain redirection and all that figured out. And what I ended up doing was actually buying a dummy domain. And I'm not even going to announce the domain on here because you go to it, it just goes to Flash Media Server site. But then I managed that domain with something they call DNS30. It's a third-party service that helps you get through their, I guess for another word, better words, their juggernaut of settings. And all their stuff is runs on XML and APIs. But about an hour after going into the setup, I was running on a large EC2 instance, and which will handle about 1,000 people on the stream. And that cost me 44 cents an hour to run the EC2 instance, and then 10 cents a gig upbound, 15 cents a gig down. And if you figure if you have a 350 kilobit service, and I'm actually pushing a higher stream level, I'm pushing 550 to the Flash Media Server. So that's what most people will be getting on the downside. You could have a pretty good crowd in each show for under $20. And what I found was that on Thursday when I did this for the very first time, I started because this the cool thing about it, it's on demand, so you can shut it down when you're done, so you're not incurring the 44 cents an hour on the EC2 server, which really is the bulk, was the big cost. If you left it up all month, you do the math on that, it's pretty expensive. But for a 1 or 2 hour event, not bad. But I left the server up for 10 hours. I had, looking at the log files, I had about 500 people come in and out during the stream. Some stayed for a long time, some stayed for short periods. All told, believe it or not, my bill for 10 hours worth of streaming on my own Flash Media Server with a very high availability of bandwidth, $8.67. And wow. So, you know, awesome. It's not bad considering that I've got back no YouTube or no Ustream branding, none of their ads, none of their stuff popping up on the website. It's missing some things that I wish it would have because, you know, the when you're dealing with Ustream, you've got the ability to record. You've got the ability to, once it's done playing, it basically brings up an old episode. So there's some things I have to do on the player side to kind of get that dialed in, but I'm just going to hire someone to code me out a player that will fall back to a media file when it's not live, and voila. So I have, I'm going to continue to use Ustream, and I'm going to continue to use Justin, but more in kind of a replay mode. So when I'm done with the kind of like the live event, and we've maybe replayed for a couple of hours and got the bulk of the people there that wanted to watch, then I'll bring the stream down, which I normally have to do anyway, process the video, and when I come back up, then I'll come back up on Ustream or Justin and use them for replay. And I'm pretty pleased. And, you know, I guess we'll play with it for a month and see what it's going to cost. But I wrote an article on Geek News Central yesterday about this service. And the thing that really set my set me into wanting to use this is that it's basically I'm getting control back. And that is, you know, Rob, I'm all about control, right?
Well, it's kind of nice to have control, you know? I mean, especially when it gets back to advertisers and things popping up on your stream that, you know, maybe you want, maybe you don't want.
Right.
So I can totally get that.
And
plus, it doesn't really sound that expensive to have that kind of control, so.
Yeah, and I think that's the, you know, that's the thing I like the most is that, you know, I'm back in control. I'm sure if I had a Leo crowd and there was 600, 700, 800 or 1,000 people in the stream at all times, then it might get, I'd have to weigh the cost. But you look at what BitGravity charges for a month of service. You know, it's like a $400 or $500 bill to do that. And if you go out and price all the different services that are out there, they say, okay, you can have 100 people on your stream and you can use 15 gigs of bandwidth. And once you're over that, then you go on a paper gig or you have to upgrade your plan and you have to sign for a contract for a year. And so they have these capital investments in these systems in which they really have no way around. This is game changer because I literally, if we decided to roll from this show to a to like a podcast awards where I'd have 5,000 people on the stream, we could be sitting here doing what we're doing. I could implement another instance, bring the instance up online. I'd have to make one small change on the website, but I could essentially come basically make a pretty seamless switch to go to a higher instance level. They've got it so you can ramp this thing up to support 100,000 people on a stream. Now, that comes with a price from a bandwidth standpoint, but from the server infrastructure, you know, if we're doing a 1 or 2 hour big event, I mean, almost nothing. You know, I can bring up their largest instance and $3, $4, $5 an hour or something like that. And it's like I'm running 20 huge servers. And so it scales when I need to have it scale.
Yeah, I think need these.
Whoops, sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
No.
Yeah, I think we actually need these kind of services, you know, if we're going to do more live streaming online to, you know, these new set-top boxes. And if those services are going to become more popular and, you know, and live streaming becomes more popular, you know, there needs to be a way for people to be able to scale their broadcast and not have it, you know, put them out of business.
Yeah. Now, Chase, you were going to say something. What were you going to say?
Well, you brought up a great point, and that was ownership. When you go through a service like Ustream or Justin TV, you know, you have the embed. If someone clicks on that embed, it takes them to Justin TV or it takes them to Ustream. The beauty of, especially like what you got here, you know, live.geeknewscentral.com, they come here, they're going to stay here. It helps build your brand. It helps build your community. Instead of someone else's community. And that's huge. And like you said, you know, you compare like Amazon service to BitGravity, the cost is just, it's a no-brainer at this point. And I really hope that because of Amazon, we're going to see that increased competition for these other services, maybe a more professional grade service that's a more affordable price point because of what Amazon is doing.
Well, you know, they have simply changed the game here. Now, this gets even more exciting because they already partnered with the Wowza folks. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, up to this point, I begged Ustream to make my stream available on Apple devices. They would never make my stream re-encoded and available for people that were coming to Ustream or even on the embeds on my website so that when people came there with an iPad, they basically, it didn't work. And so what I can do now, and this is a little bit more money, is I set up, they've got a partnership with Wowza. So I bring up a Wowza server And I could actually, through a little bit of manipulation, I could have a Wowza server running and an Adobe Flash Media server running together, and I can serve everyone on a demand basis. And a little more, you know, trickier to manage, obviously, but and some setup is involved on Wowza, whereas the Flash Media server, it just basically gives you links. It's pretty remarkable. They in the CloudFormation setting, and it's just on the web page. It's on their console. I click on the stream, and it tells me right on here where the outputs are. It tells me where the FMS server is, where I'm supposed to push to, what the stream ID is, and the video source link that goes into the Flash player. And this is Rob. Having run servers before and run streaming boxes, this is pretty cool, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, I really like these type of services. I've gone to all of my hosting too onto, you know, like cloud based type of deals. You know, I'm with the whole Rackspace cloud thing, you know, with all of our clients, and I mean, this cloud hosting, these services platforms like this are just outstanding. And what's really amazing is that it's coming from Amazon of all people, you know?
Yeah.
That's the amazing part.
I wrote a big write-up over on NewTek's blog, and I'm getting private emails from guys that have done business with big systems or big companies. And they say this is going to destroy some of these guys' business models. You know, they've had such high margins built into these services that, he said privately, he said if he'd known about this, one of the guys did an event for MTV recently, and, you know, he's like, wow, unbelievable, you know, and could have scaled up, and, you know, they had enough budget that they could support 100,000 people on a stream. But anyway, very, very cool stuff going on by Amazon and what they're doing in the cloud. Of course, they've been in news negatively this week as well. And they actually have had some server outage. So with, you know, this advancement comes challenges from time to time. This has been their biggest outage they've had, and they're still not completely recovered from it. They've had one of their East Coast servers. And matter of fact, this stream is actually going through an East Coast server. But they've been basically out. So their website basically says that everything is pretty much operation normal, with the exception of Elastic Compute Cloud in North Virginia. So they're seeing instance connectivity and latency and error rates. And this has been ongoing. So you can see here is the, you know, this is going on a couple of days now. Let me look at their last update. Actually come down here at the bottom. April 23rd, we continue to work on unblocking the bottleneck that is limiting the speed, which we can reestablish connections between volumes and their instances. We'll continue to keep everyone updated as we have additional information. So this has been big. So I don't know if you guys have been following this at all or you've heard about it. So what's the, you know, I could have been on a data server that basically wasn't up. I had no choice but to come up on another service. But I guess that's the beauty of options, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's definitely, it's going to happen that these services are going to go down. And as we kind of move more toward cloud-based services platforms, we're going to be more reliant on these things. So there's going to be increased pressure on these networks to keep their servers up, because if they do go down, people are just not going to be able to get access to the things that they need to get access to. And that really hasn't been so much the case in the past. So because people have primarily kept their stuff local and you know, there's been, you know, sites online that you're linking to get content, but it's not like your personal files or your photos or your music or those kind of things. So, you know, these things can cause some serious damage to the reputations of the companies. Now, fortunately, a lot of these cloud services are not really scaled to be very large services right now. So
there's some big boys running on these things.
Oh, well, they're more and more, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, you think about what's going on with Microsoft with the Office 365 service, and I mean, it's all heading that direction, and it's going to be really the folks that can keep their servers up and running are the ones that are going to win as you look out in the future.
Yeah, and what we're doing is a cross combination. We've got some of our sites up on the cloud, and then we have fallback onto boxes that basically we own. So that's kind of what we've done in critical services, you know, like our stat system that just can never go down. We met with a client earlier this week, very large client that's going to come in and put in an enterprise level stat system for just their media offerings. They've got about 150 media offerings, and we know the type of volume they're doing, which we can support. But I was like, these guys, I'm like, listen, this is something that cannot go down. And we built our system where basically within 10 seconds of a server having a hiccup, the system can detect that there's something wrong. And then we make there's a dynamic switch that is essentially thrown in some routing tables. And really probably within about 45 to 60 seconds, everything should stabilize. And, but it's just one of the, and even with our current operation, the only time we've invoked that is when we were basically, okay, kill the server, you know, and let's see what happens, make sure it works. And, and it's kind of scary. You're sitting there and you are physically turning the server off and you're saying, okay, is this thing going to redirect like it's supposed to? And you kind of hold your breath and it picks up and you're like, whew, you know, that scenario worked. Let's try this different one. But, there has to be a certain reliability level too, and Dropbox and some other folks have been affected here. So,
And it does kind of raise an interesting question. I think as you look out in the future, as storage becomes pretty cheap and it becomes cheaper and cheaper all the time. I mean, we're talking about 2-3 terabyte hard drives here,
right?
They're going to be pretty reasonably priced. So we have these two things going on. We have the resource of the cloud, and then we also have what I call personal storage, right? Your own personal cloud is potential in it. And it really makes me wonder if there's going to be some synergy really that comes out of all of these outages that says, well, you know, I want to have a copy of everything that's mine on my personal cloud somewhere. And then also upon, some hosted cloud platform that I primarily pull from. But if that goes down, then I still have access to my personal cloud. So, I know that's how I live here with, a Windows home server.
Yep.
Is that I've got both of those, right? I can, I can have stuff up in the cloud and I can have it down in my own personal cloud.
And there's nothing worse than sitting in front of a computer and all of a sudden it just going dark.
Yeah.
I've had it happen, and you just kind of push the chair back and you go into this mild panic and you think, when was the last backup? And with Windows Home Server, I basically can, as long as the home client's been running the night before, which they so far so good, I can recover back at least until the last backup, which is usually not that many hours. I've had it happen once. I had a hard drive blow a hard drive, and within about 2 hours, I was back rebuilt and up and running. And it took me longer to find the recovery disk than it did the. So, Chase, are you guys doing anything cloud stuff? Have you guys experimented with it at all?
Not too much. I mean, because of the scale that we're at right now, we don't have hundreds of thousands of viewers, which would be awesome, by the way. Right now everything's on a shared hosting service right now. And we use the Justin TV services and the Ustream services for streaming stuff. What Amazon is doing right now and the affordability factor in doing that makes us think, that's something we could probably swing. The thing with the cloud services, that always worries me is, what if, obviously, like, say, for example, if you're using your Gmail, you have it all up on the cloud, and then all of a sudden, you're one of those 5%ers or 3%ers that you can't access the service, or they accidentally delete your account or something along those lines. And so, you know, I was leaning back thinking, maybe I should go back to doing some sort of IMAP or some sort of thing where I can have a downloaded local copy. And like you guys, I also have a Windows Home Server and back it up locally. As we go forward with these cloud-based solutions, it always worries me a little bit that maybe we're putting too much up on the cloud. And so to have that balance of a local backup, an offsite backup, and online would probably be ideal for me and for what we do.
Got to go ahead.
Backup of a backup, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 3-2-1, right? I mean, yeah. If you put everything up on the cloud and say, oh, well, you know, it's fine. It's the cloud. I can get the stuff from the cloud everywhere. You might be setting yourself up for failure. I mean, you look what happened with some of these server outages, you know, Gmail canceling accounts. You know, it was only like the 0.5% or whatever they called it. But what if you were that percent, you know, and it affected you? So, you know, having the local backup, having the offsite backup, and having the stuff in the cloud, then I'll probably feel a little bit more comfortable.
One of the guys that had a free, I'm getting a text, I'm help, and basically one of the guys that got a free account, his free account time ran out, and he's like, I can't publish. I'm like, I think all you gotta do is go in and pay. So Tim, if you're watching the show, I think all you gotta do is go into the store at Blueberry and pay for your hosting. I think that's all it needs to be done to get it activated. Now the guys may have to go in and reactivate the account, but I'll see if I can help you here in about an hour. So some things never end, you know. Let's see here. Let me go ahead and get into the, I guess we've talked about this cloud stuff quite a while. Let me go ahead and look at what else I've got here in the stack for us today. And I mentioned Dropbox a little bit earlier, and the music associations, the movie folks, which we all have this, you know, love-hate relationship with, they have basically been pressuring Dropbox and other of these cloud storage folks to allow the government access to these files in, if they ask for them. So essentially, the folks at Dropbox have told their customers, as set forth in our privacy policy and in compliance with the United States law, Dropbox cooperates with the United States law enforcement and receives valid legal process which may require Dropbox to provide the contents of your private Dropbox. In these cases, Dropbox removed Dropbox encryption from the files before providing them to law enforcement. So if you're not encrypting your files yourself before they go up there, and Uncle Sam wants to see your stuff, you're going to basically be, your content's going to be made available. And I think we all can understand any type of due process. But at what point then does it become an issue? Or, you know, I guess for a better word, is Dropbox and these other services being used as the new peer-to-peer source? Or are they sneaker netting copyrighted material? And is the, you know, is the RIAA and those folks justified to go into our private directories? You would think that they, in order to do that, they would have to come after us personally and sue us and then do that through some sort of a discovery process. But it appears to me that their angle on this is to get the government to do the dirty work for them. Any thoughts?
It's just a fishing expedition, really. The way I see it is right now, Amazon had a huge response with their on-site storage service where they responded. It's an extension of your hard drive, essentially. You know, where people are allowed to go ahead and upload their music and access it through a phone client or through a web client. It's your music. You're just uploading it to storage space up on the cloud. In this instance here, you know, it's frustrating because it's like the RIAA, which in, you know, with my community of friends and viewers and listeners, they don't really like them too much just because of the fact that, know, you go out, you buy a CD, you rip it, it's your own, you know, your own stuff, and that's so you want access to it from another place. Now, the RIAA thinks, oh, well, this if it's copied and if it's on a hard drive, it must be illegal. It's like now you're guilty until proven innocent in this regard. It's frustrating because it's like, great, now they're going to do fishing expeditions, and it's frustrating. And it's like, come on. I mean, please, seriously, like, stop.
But I think they're probably more, you know, obviously there's the whole situation with that, with the CloudFront stuff that they made available for us to put music up on Amazon. but I think what they're going after for the folks at Dropbox is I think they're seeing or feeling that content's being shared via those accounts. I think that was their main process, not so much focusing on people storing their content, although there is issues there as well. But, and I think if I've been storing my music up, maybe I shouldn't say this too loud, I've been storing my music up on EC2 for years. I've got 65 or 70 gigs of music. I've got probably a terabyte of pictures, you know, so.
I think it's a lot more common for people that have, you know, like cloud type, you know, hosting accounts where, yeah, I mean, I've kept all sorts of media files up on servers that were in folders that were not necessarily available on the web. But yeah, I think, I think people have been doing this a long time. But actually, I think where the real issue, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is that they're really scared about how easy it is, right, for you to share your password or something with a friend of yours or whatever, and for them to go in and get access to all those music files right over the internet and download them and share them with all their friends and all this kind of stuff like that. I think that's what they're really concerned about.
So time will tell. And there wasn't too much of a stink that came out of this, but this happened earlier in the week, and I think people expected it. But the battle continues against the pirateers, those of us that are doing stuff legally. And yeah, but going back to your point, Chase, you're right. Anytime that you're doing anything peer-to-peer, anytime you're storing something online, they seem to say that we're all being bad boys, not doing things right. Hey, got this. I got Paul Allen's book in the mail as a review. It came in the day that the embargo was was raised. So it tells you where I was in the priority list. So I got Paul Allen's Idea Man sitting here, and I didn't read anything last night, but I'm up to page 183. This is he's making the rounds and talking on the talk shows, and he was on 60 Minutes last week, kind of a weird place for him to be for a, you know, expose. But besides what he says about Bill Gates, and this is one of the best reads I've done in a while. Have either of you started to read this book or see and have a desire to?
No, I haven't. I mean, as far as on my side, I haven't really read it. I've heard all of the dirt, you know, without reading the book, but it'd be interesting to read it, but I'm not a big book reader anyway.
I think the first 80 pages, Rob, you would be fascinated with, or maybe first 100. After that, maybe not so much, but, you know, I knew about, because I've read several of Bill Gates' books. I've read stuff on Microsoft before. And I've got a frog going on here. I need one of those kill buttons. But the pure gambling that they did in the early days of basically calling the folks at Altair in Albuquerque and telling them, yeah, we got a DOS for your machine. Yeah. We're working on it. It's almost finished. Where, in fact, they had written no code. No code whatsoever.
Called vaporware.
Right. And so really what ended up happening was these guys had been getting mainframe time for several years since Bill was an eighth grader or something like that. They were, at the time, the only way you could really get on a computer was through a teletype console, which they paid by the hour to have access to a mainframe, and you shared time on that box, kind of like cloud computing. And these guys, this is where they got their chops. This is where they learned to do assembly language. This is where they learned to do BASIC. They spent hours and hours getting free time. They would do it in the middle of the night, all kinds of stuff to get basically their skills down. And one thing that I found fascinating was really we have Microsoft probably owes a lot of their existence to the U.S. government, because these guys went and worked on a federal program where there were, not a federal program, but a program that was involved in power grid management. And Paul actually learned assembly language at that time. And that was where they really got their ends on how these processor languages work. I mean, it was that I never knew. This first part of this story is pretty remarkable. Chase, have you followed this at all?
Well, being in Microsoft country, in the backyard here, absolutely. Here you hear about the stories and the New Mexico stuff, and it's really quite fascinating. In just a couple of decades, how the whole everything has snowballed into what it is today. I'm more of an audiobook reader, so I probably won't pick up the hardcover or softcover. I'm more of an Audible guy. So if Paul Allen reads the book, I think that'd be excellent. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Cause I do a lot of commuting, a lot of driving for my job. So I would definitely pick it up on Audible, for sure. When it does.
And the only reason I'm reading is because they sent it to me for free. I read everything if I do read, it's on the Kindle, through the iPad app or through Audible. So same thing, but it's been a great read. It's worth the $14 or whatever it is to pick it up. Let's switch gears here and talk a little bit about Apple. Boy, they're always in the news. But total shipments of new Apple TVs topped 2,820,000 were sold last quarter. This number pretty much set me back in the chair. I didn't fully expect that they would sell that many versions or that many copies of Apple TV. Are either of you surprised on the numbers on this?
I'm surprised, honestly, with the Roku box for one being a little bit cheaper, and they have different versions. My buddy, his name's Jason. He had an Apple TV, the new one, on pre-order. He was ready to pull the trigger. And I told him, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to get locked down with the Apple ecosystem? You can get a Roku box, get more options. You can get to the Tech Podcast channel. You got a lot of really cool things to do. So we went ahead and pulled the trigger on a Roku. So I saw the same news result that you saw, Todd. And I was just like, wow, who's buying these? And then I thought about it. And I was thinking, oh, you know who's buying these? People that have the older versions and they're just maybe doing an upgrade. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if these are brand new customers or maybe existing old customers that had the old versions, but I'm a little surprised too.
Now, let me pose a question out there. I'm not a big Apple fan myself, but could it be some connection with this whole AirPlay technology?
They've limited the utilization of that. They've hampered that so much. It's just, you can't go from all apps. Mm-hmm. But it what shocks me about this number is you have a very limited, maybe people are just getting it for the movies and their stuff that's on their computers. But this tells me that if they finally decide to open up the Apple TV infrastructure, which I think they will at some point, I can't see them not. But they will have, you think the controls on the iPhone were bad. I think the controls going into an app for the Apple TV would be huge. I think this may, I actually talked to the guys about it. I said, those type of numbers, obviously if they ever open it up, we'd have to jump immediately and build, like we built apps for the Roku and for Boxy and Samsung IPTV. We would have to jump immediately. And matter of fact, we're going into some more devices here soon. We'll have announcement on 5 or 6 more devices we're going to get in one fell swoop. But this is big. I think it's a big number. Just shows you where people are going. And it may be people that are cord cutting that are looking for more devices. But overall, pretty excited about that number. Let's talk about YouTube for a second. YouTube videos are now served in WebM. You go to the website, it's no longer in Flash. All new videos uploaded to YouTube are now transcoded into WebM. WebM, of course, is an open media file format. And you guys maybe know or don't know it, but I've been experimenting with WebM here. And actually, when we were at NAB, the Sorensen folks were right next to the booth. And we talked to them. I wasn't real happy with some of their logarithms. And quite frankly, they're having a very expensive tool, $700, to do conversions into WebM. There's some open source stuff, but it just doesn't work very good. And so let me load this. I basically talked to them and been working with one of their developers over there and trying to refine the WebM profile, I guess, for a better word, in order to get a better squeeze or a better conversion. I'm going to show you guys this application. Let's see if I can get it in here. You can tell it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I still have morning voice. What this is basically add the media. And then you select the profile that you want to do the conversion with. And from there, it drops it into a folder and automatically FTP it to your site. So I can just start it. Forget it, and it does it, which is pretty cool. They do a variety of codecs. They'll do PlayStation, mobile, Wii, digital signage, even Blu-ray. So all kinds of different encoding formats. And but WebM comes out a little bit bigger than an MP4, M4V file size. The quality is just about the same. It's almost indiscernible between it, and it's open source. But here's the problem. You know, not a lot of people are using WebM, but Firefox will not play HTML5 natively without our videos natively without WebM. You have to do Flash fallback for MP4s. So what do you think the future holds for WebM?
I don't know. I think there's so much momentum out there around H.264 and that side of the fence that it's going to take years for WebM to overtake that. But it could happen. I mean, stranger things could happen. But I think your point about the tools is key. Not too many folks are going to be encoding in WebM on a $700 software package. If that's really the only package that does a good job.
And, you know, and there's some, and I'm sure it's just because it's early, there'll be more. But, you know, I'm all about automation and trying to make things easy. And so, you know, that was the reason I went down that road. You can command line it, but how many people want to command line it, you know?
Not too many.
I'm sure people are saying, "Well, you're a geek. You should command line it." Yeah, I'm a optimized geek.
Well, and a lot of people, you know, they'll create a video in one of these other formats and upload it to YouTube, and YouTube will do with all that transcoding on their end. So, all of the YouTube creators aren't going to see much of a change in what they do. But I think it's folks that are creating content outside of the YouTube platform. Are the ones that, you know, I think they're going to stick with what they know.
Yeah, I think so too. Boy, I'm getting in text. Tim, if you're watching, I can't do nothing for another hour. You're going to have to wait. I'll have to turn you over to Angelo. And it's the holiday weekend, so normally the guys aren't doing business calls during the weekend. Hulu shut down the access to its site on the Playbook. So even though Playbook was just released yesterday, I guess Hulu didn't like the idea of allowing Playbook users to stream media from it. So they shut her down. So, you know, is this, you know, what is the story with Hulu and tablets and just, you know, they were accessing their website at Hulu.com. They weren't even, you know, they weren't even had some rogue app. It was just HTML. What is the story with these guys?
They want people to buy Hulu Plus and make money. And I guess their ultimate fear is if you're not with your butt planted in front of your computer screen, desktop, or a laptop, that that you know you're taking that content mobile and on a tablet, and oh God, we want you to buy our app and make money that way. I really see this as purely a money-driven thing where they want to have an agreement to make an app for BlackBerry on the Playbook, just like Hulu Plus on the PlayStation 3, just like Hulu Plus on your iPad. And, you know, it's just like, it's but, the same story. That's why I see
it. But the difference is the Playbook supports Flash. So, you know, it would have been just like the experience on your desktop. You would, you know, if you have Hulu Plus and you have Flash on the device, there's no reason for them to block. It's the same experience as on your computer. So this is where I'm confused. I don't understand why they did it.
They don't want to give any free content. That's the thing. They don't even want to do that. They want you to, if it's a like a mobile handheld 7-inch tablet, they want you to buy that app. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah, Todd, I think there's a lot of pressure that the studios are putting on all of these platforms based on, you know, more and more people moving that direction. I think that there's also a perception that these slate tablet type of player devices are almost becoming more and more plausible as TV replacements. And I think they're feeling a little threatened about that. I mean, they don't really know what's going to happen with this whole slate thing. It could explode into something huge. Who knows? I think that there's been a little bit of weakness with them here, but that just could be because of, you know, the ability to produce them and meet the demand out there. But I think that the studio industry is a little bit scared of these platforms, these new slate type platforms as a replacement for TV, and they just don't want too much free content out there. And I totally, you know, agree with what's being said here, that they're, you know, it's all about making money. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as we look into the next few years, is that these studios are going to want to figure out ways to make more and more money on the digital side, because they're seeing it a serious threat to the cable kind of monopoly that they have right now, where they actually make a boatload of money on the cable TV side right now.
Yeah, and I guess maybe that's part of it. I don't know. It's an odd deal. It really is. But
it's all about control.
Yeah, control.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of control, New York Times sold 100,000 digital subscriptions in 3 weeks. You think this is a big number? You think this is a sign that the New York Times got it right? You know, you look at this posting here, and they're $100 million website. I don't think this is a, you know, this is necessarily a big number, but considering the price people are having to pay for the subscription, it's 100,000 on track for 3 weeks.
Yeah. Well, I'm most definitely seeing a bigger kind of macro trend here, where content, these content companies are really putting forth a lot of effort to figure out ways to monetize. And premium type services, premium type content, it's got to be outstanding content before people are going to pay for it. But I can just, I mean, I see it in all corners, this kind of desire on the part of the content folks to actually make money from online content. But what's really difficult about it is that the direction that pulls digital content is more towards free. And it has always been that way. But I think that the costs of it and those kind of things kind of drives the cost of these things towards free. And it's going to be difficult to try and convert millions and millions of people to start thinking about getting content online through a paid type of platform. I think it's going to take years, and who knows if it's really ever going to fully be accepted. I mean, it's possible, and it seems like that might be you know, a good thing, because content providers need to be paid to produce good content. So it's, I'm a little torn on it.
Yeah, I think you hit it right there. I mean, in premium content, I mean, if you're going to be paying for a subscription to the New York Times online edition, you know, you want to get something that you're not going to get anywhere else. You want it to be a premium, unique experience. And yeah, there are a lot of people out there who just like to go to the net. They grab their news real quick. And if they're going to have to pay for it, they're like, well, I'll just go somewhere else. Now, obviously, there's some diehard people out there who want, they got to have the New York Times. They got to have it. All right, here we go. I'm going to pay my money for it. But I think you hit it. You got to have something unique that you get for what you pay for. If I'm just getting a digital version for I'm just like, so 100,000, is that a lot? Well, I mean, considering how many normal subscribers that they have across the nation, I really don't think that's a lot. I think if for them to make it viable, they're probably going to need a lot more than that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see where it goes over time. You know, they've got a business to stay in business, and they got stockholders to keep happy. So, you know, they get that big iron, all that printing press and ink and, you know, some staff and everything else to support. So, I don't know. We'll watch and see where it goes for sure.
Yeah, I think that's the bigger message there, is that, you know, a lot of these companies have these legacy revenue models to support the infrastructure to produce the content, and those newspapers just aren't selling anymore.
Right.
That was creating that. So it's got to be replaced somehow. Also, we're going to see more and more of these news outlets kind of go down the tubes.
You know,
well, you look.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, you look at what happened up here in the Seattle metro area, the Seattle Post Intelligence or Seattle PI, they shut down their entire, you know, print operations, and they went completely online. They let off a lot of staff, but they've been online now for, I want to say, about a year and a half exclusively, and they've done well. You know, they still provide good content. They're no longer under that joint operating agreement with the Seattle Times. So I think what you're going to see as the future comes is a lot of these traditional outlets with the legacy print and the ink that can't sustain with the normal traditional advertising model. They're going to move towards, if they still want to provide that news and information to their communities, they're going to start moving to an online-only platform. And so far, I mean, Seattle PI, you know, they've done it. You're probably going to see that happen with a lot of other traditional outlets as well.
But, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, and with that comes a lot of slashing of costs, and they have to get back to being, you know, more like a regular blogger type of, you know, where the costs of publishing have to stay extremely low. I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure on, you know, on the content folks, especially the legacy kind of content folks, to slash costs more and more and more. I think we're going to see that, you know, especially in the TV side. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on those big studios to cut their production costs.
One thing that I've seen is, you know, being travel a lot, that's really the only time I even consider reading a newspaper. But, you know, they throw a USA Today at my doorstep of my in my hotel room every morning. And usually I walk out and I kick that thing into the room. And by the time I leave, I've got a stack of them that I've never looked at. And so I've just started asking the hotels not to even give me a newspaper anymore. And it's, you know, because most of the news is 3 days old anyway. So I don't understand the full, you know, I don't understand why they, well, let's look at the model that New York Times picked. They priced it way higher than what it would cost to actually get the print model. To me, why would you price a digital higher than the print? So I can actually get the physical newspaper here in Hawaii cheaper than it was to subscribe to the actual newspaper. Is it because they're trying to keep that printing press open?
Yeah, they're trying to subsidize their normal traditional operations with their digital operations. They're trying to use it as an assistance, as a crutch, if you will. So it's like, maybe if you price it more towards a traditional, maybe electronic price point, where usually electronic versions are cheaper than the traditional versions, maybe they'll get more subscribers.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's hard to tell. Hey, Tim, if you're watching, I made a switch for you. You may be able to get access to your account. So try it. Text me if it's good. Google has taken issue with Roku's YouTube channel. Roku has never offered officially sanctioned YouTube channel. And many people, like I have been using the private channel that was available. But they've been told to take it down. And so the YouTube, private YouTube channel is no longer available. But the folks at Roku say that they are working with YouTube to try to get the content back up. And part of the problem has been that the Roku up to a couple months ago was not capable of running pre-rolls, interstitials, or post-rolls. But now that the Roku has got the code in it to be able to run pre-roll ads, interstitials, and post-rolls, not necessarily overlays, maybe YouTube will be willing to come on board and build an app so that they can monetize the content that they want to on those devices. And it's different, though. It's a different implementation. So, you know, it's something that we've been tossing around. We got to figure out how we're going to ultimately pay for the ongoing development and cost that cost us to really support these channels. And it's very significant. You know, what do you think about pre-rolls and post-rolls coming to the Roku device and to content? And not only just YouTube, but all the content on these devices.
I think it's inevitable that, you know, it's going to happen. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just one of these things that you, as much as you hate to, and I'm not a purveyor of pre-roll. Matter of fact, I was listening to Twit. Have you seen Twit lately, Rob?
I haven't watched their live stream here recently. No, why?
My wife was out. They went swimming yesterday with the kids, and I had stuff to do here, and I got done, and so once in a while I'll watch Leo's show just to kind of catch up on what's going on with them, and he said something pretty profound near the end of his show. He basically said, "Well, I'm not going to talk badly about pre-rolls or post-rolls because we may be going to them soon too." And I thought that was a curious admission by Leo. So obviously he's looking at inventory availability and being able to help monetize his content. At the same time, I think pre-rolls can be done better in a new media space. But at the same time, people so hate pre-rolls. But I guess if it's the price of admission, maybe people will be more willing to put up with it.
And Leo could be seeing dollar signs there being offered his way.
Well, he's building a brand new studio, 10,000 square foot studio too. So he's got to pay for that.
Yeah. I mean, these kind of situations with pre and post roll, with the new media, I think you hit it right, Todd. I mean, it's going to happen. And with a lot of people out there not paying for this content to watch, on the net and on their mobile devices, I think it's going to happen. You're going to see a 15 or a 30 second pre-roll. And a lot of people now have just kind of learned to live with it. I don't think a lot of people get too pissed off about it. It's just kind of the price of admission for what you're getting for that content.
I think the thing that annoys me the most, though, is if I go over to CNN and I watch one of their videos, a 2 minute clip, and then I'm watching another 30 second ad. They play him every time. And, you know, I'm like, okay, there's got to be some counter there. How many times are you going to show me the same ad in a row before you're going to let me look at some of your... And I leave their website because they hammer me with pre-rolls. If they give me two or three, okay, cool. Then the next one, don't show me another one.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Leo, I think he's going to keep his mid-roll host-read stuff. Right. So he's actually... By doing these pre-rolls and post-rolls, he's actually adding another revenue layer to his podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
The And I think, too, at the very end of his last program, he took Kevin Rose and the original Twit team from Twit 1 over to the new cottage. And they are, boy, he's investing a huge, huge, huge amount of money. You think about a 10,000 square foot space. Based on maybe the house that you live in today, that's a huge area, and two floors. It's got a basement that's really not usable, but they're going to set up like four or five sets, and so he's doing a major capital investment into his programming. But you know, the thing I worry about with Twit is, you know, do you think the Twit model can survive without Leo?
Probably not. It's hard to say. I think that network has a lot of momentum right now, but it's really, yeah. I mean, I think the vast majority of people tune in to probably hear Leo, but.
And I don't want people to take that the wrong way. You know, yeah. I don't, obviously Leo's a great guy and he's doing, groundbreaking stuff over there. And sure. We don't want, you know, but my thought process always is in any type of a business model, okay, if this person leaves, does the business collapse or can it continue? And not to say that Leo's going to leave, but it goes to, for what I'm trying to put together with stuff that we're doing, you know, do I need five linchpins that are going to be the ones that are going to carry, you know, the other 20 shows that are going to be in a private network? Or, you know, do we hope that the 25 medium shows will be able to, to have the same impact. I guess only time will tell. I know what Tech Podcast does with its 120 some shows. And we we reach significant audience numbers. But it takes 120 shows to do that too. And some are stronger than others. But
Todd, I was going to say, to answer your question, I think Twit can survive without Leo. And the reason being is, I mean, you see what he's doing now with the network where he's adding in more content and more shows without him included in it. I'm looking at the chat room here and I see, Cliff saying that, you know, he didn't listen to Twit or Mac Break Weekly for 3 weeks. I actually did. And the content was actually maybe a little bit better. Sometimes Leo can, go off on a tangent and, you know, people don't say anything because, oh, it's Leo. I've met Leo. Leo's a great guy, and I think he provides great content. But I think he sees the future, too, where, you know, he's not going to be around there forever. But he's building the foundation and the groundwork for a solid network of content. And I think that's what his vision is around Twit. So I believe it can survive. I mean, he's brought in, you know, Tom Merritt from CNET, you know, brought back Sarah Lane. You know, he's bringing in top people in the world of the media space. So I think it can survive. I'm almost certain of it.
Cliff was saying in the chat that he hates the long ads. And I think in this space, we have to understand that in order to make it work, my ads are a minute and a half. In my show, and the advertisers pay very good dollars to be in my show, and you have to perform. If you don't perform and you don't get the trials and you don't get the people to convert, they're not going to be advertisers. And and I think the audiences understand that, and because, you know, we give them an hour 15 minutes of content and we put in 5 minutes worth of ads, you look at that ratio, that's about 25 minutes less than what you would get on a standard. You know, you're going to get that commercial at a minute a pop five times or six times in that hour programming, where we give you 3 minutes in one pop on a, you know, an hour and 15 minute show. At least I do. So, it's all relative, I think. But it is what it is, and it's the way the space is working right now. These advertisers don't give stuff away for free.
Yeah, I think, though, you know, Cliff is making, you know, some comments, you know, that I definitely agree with, you know, in the chat room here, that I think Leo's ads can be a little bit long. I think most ads should be probably around, you know, a minute, maybe a minute and a half, something like that. But I think, you know, I listen to Leo's shows, and I mean he can talk about the Audible folks for like 7 minutes or something.
But
like
you know
that.
Something,
I mean,
Rob?
On and on.
He is setting the bar in conversions.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
Yep.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not saying that it probably doesn't work. It's just that it does pull the audience totally away from the core reason that they're there, is to listen to content about, you know, a particular technology topic.
But then again, you're not getting 20 minutes of ads for an hour and 15. You're getting 3 to 6 minutes of ads for an hour's worth of content.
But I have to say, Leo's getting closer and closer to that number.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's building That's a 10,000 right. foot facility. And he's got staff, and to do that, it costs money. And if the audience stays and they don't go away, he said they did 5 million downloads last month. And now I don't know if that was network wide or just one show, but you know, let's just think about that for a second. He said 5 million downloads. So if we take 5 million and we divide that by 1,000, that leaves us with 50,000. And then per ad, I've heard that they get some very good CPM rates. So let's just say that the CPM, let's just use a CPM of 20, which is pretty basic in the space. You know, you know, that's $1 million.
Yeah, I think he gets higher than 20, though.
And that's, you know, across a network, that's but $1 million when you have how many mouths to feed and how many employees to write, doesn't go very far. Yeah. You know, that you eat that up in an instant. Yeah, five, six, seven, eight employees, and it's gone.
One thing to add here is that you know, a lot of people, I don't think mind the ads.
Yeah, they don't.
I think if you had a lot of people, I mean, you know, I know Cliff and a lot of us, I think we're kind of splitting hairs a little bit when, oh, I don't like the 6 to 8 minutes, but maybe 2 to 3 minutes is okay. It's one of those situations where people like Leo's ads, and he gets good conversion because of the way he delivers them and the way that they're authentic,
right,
and real and personal. You know, a lot of these advertisers, they rather pay for something personable and something that feels real, than opposed to, I'm going to read a 30 to 60 second ad here about X advertiser. You know, it feels more authentic. So when people are listening to that hour and 10, 20 minute show, and if there is a 7 or 8 minute ad about Audible, you know, hey, Audible, by the way, you can send me the check for mentioning it again. But you know, it's like, you know, it doesn't bother me. What bothers me really is the pre-scripted minute and a half, 2 minute stuff. That's the stuff that bothers me. I can get through the 6 minutes. If they're really passionate about a book, even if it doesn't relate to the content at hand, you know, I might check that out.
Yep.
So people do. That's the kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff that doesn't bother me.
Yeah. They and you know, and it's been kind of funny because, I talk to some of the same advertisers, advertise with Leo, advertises on our network, and we have conversation with the media buyers all the time. And, you know, Leo's doing very good. He's doing very, very, very well. And, I kind of leave it at that. So it's, while people may be irritated with it, the advertisers are coming back each quarter and spending as much or more money. And that's, you know, that's the very important thing in the space. Yeah. So
yeah, I wanted to mention one other thing too. If you go back in time, and this is kind of a, you know, it's a little bit of a kind of like a historical perspective on this whole HostRed thing.
Yeah.
Is that I'm sure Leo learned back in the early days of his, you know, his broadcasting days, is that the advertisers would pay a premium for HostRed. So if the host of the show would actually, and I had this same situation happen to me with my show, is that the sponsors would come in and say, sure, I'll buy an ad on your show. You know, it would be like a 30-second or, you know, pre-done ad. I'll pay you a certain amount for this ad, but I'll pay you a bonus amount if you do the ad. Right.
Right.
And that's been going on broadcast radio for eons, right? And so he's basically taking that same model and transposing it into the podcasting area. And back in those days, even on the broadcast side, you couldn't go that long. I mean, these 7 to 12 minute ads that he does for you know, some of these sponsors, he doesn't do it for all of them. I mean, he does it for certain ones that there's kind of content that you can talk about, but that's really where that comes from. And he's seeing the flexibility to go longer, and if he can draw and kind of blend this whole concept of content with the advertiser and talk about the products in a way that adds value, then I think that the advertiser gets more for that, and he'll pay a premium or a bonus for that.
But what we're also finding is, and some of the conversations we've been having just, you know, within the last couple of weeks, is that media buyers also on the digital side, unlike the radio side, digital side is all about control. Digital is about the message. It's about their message. So what we're starting to find, and we just brought on our first full-time salesperson, is that the advertisers say, hey, can we run our stuff instead? And, you know, I'm kind of like, yeah, we can, but we need to talk about it. And we're getting more inquiries now from major brands that say, here's our 30-second spot. Please run it. They don't want the host endorsement. They want control of their message. Yeah. And so, okay, let's see how that works. So maybe those that don't like the 3-minute ads will even more hate the pre-produced stuff. But we're trying to work with the buyers to say, let's, if we're going to do this, let's work on some new types of, how should I say it? Let's not see what we're going to see on TV. In other words.
Well, you know, that's where pre-roll comes in here. Right,
right, right. I mean, right.
And really, it's those are the advertisers that are not very savvy about the new medium.
Right.
That are asking for that.
Very few advertisers are savvy about any of this.
Yeah.
So those are the type of advertisers that are asking for the pre-roll stuff are the ones that aren't very sophisticated about these platforms and are trying to fit an old model into the new media space. And I think they're going to wind up backing off from that and wanting the host read stuff again.
This is, I copied some stuff up, but this is a copy of a insertion order. And what we find is that, not with this particular company, but what I have found with other companies, is that oftentimes I'll get an insertion order that has my prior quarter dates on it. And they said, here's the new insertion order. They've changed maybe one line on it, but the dates are wrong. The challenge in the digital space is that it's a lot of work to put campaigns together. And once you're in someone's system, it's just easier to put a new date on the insertion order and resend it back out, often with the same amount of money. And so half the battle is just getting on that first line, you know, getting that first, and I got a post-it note covered the amounts there, but it just to get on the first insertion. Once you're in, as long as you don't screw up, they'll just, you know, every quarter you get a new insertion order. So, so from that standpoint,
keep it flowing, right?
Yeah. So you hope when you're talking to a media buyer that they've got someone that's on the radar that they want to shoot. And if they shoot that person that's on their radar, their low performer, that you can come in there and bam, move into that spot, take that money over, and then move, you know, into his ecosystem and fall out somewhere. That's sometimes 90% of the battle. It's kind of a weird deal, but because, you know, companies come in with a fixed budget. They're saying, I'm going to spend this amount of money this year. And I know from quarter to quarter when we get RFPs, they say, this is what we've got to spend. And when I get X and out of that spend, I know what percentage that I'm falling out in. I know how much of that pie that I have been able to take. And the more pie I get tells me the better I'm doing, because often they will not publicize the performance. Sure. They don't want their competitors to know the performance. Well, we've drifted off the path here a long ways today, guys, on tech. And we've been at this an hour and 14, but we go a little longer here. Hey, Samsung has countersued Apple over the iPhone, iPad. So, you know, Apple sued Samsung. So Samsung is going to sue Apple now. So these guys are sue crazy, aren't they?
Right?
Huh?
They cancel each other out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Samsung filed patent lawsuits against Apple over the U.S. firm's iPhone and iPad in a tit-for-tat case after Apple claims Samsung smartphones and tablets slavishly copied its products. You know, how many different ways can you cut up a tablet? Does Samsung have to come up with a triangle tablet?
That sounds actually kind of cool.
Yeah, I guess it would be until you wanted to carry it or something. But
watch video or
email. Yeah,
right?
We'd be, heads would be chopped, right? So, you know, it just kind of kills me. You know, it looks like a tablet. It's got a border around it. It's got controls at the bottom. It says Samsung at the top. You know, it just blows me away. It really, really does. There's only so many ways to spin things out, but it's just Apple's way of trying to protect their turf there. So, any basis? Do you think this is just going to be a cancel out procedure, or that they got a chance of? Is there any basis to this?
I don't know.
Hey, Rob, you ever check anything out from your local library?
No.
Of course, you said you don't read too much, right?
No, I shouldn't say that.
But you don't read...
I read a lot. I just don't read paperback or hardcover books. Yeah.
Have you ever checked anything out digitally from your library?
No.
Chase, how about you?
I've had friends who've used their... I know where you're going with this, Todd. Okay. I've had friends that have used their friends. Nook to check out things from the library. But now, I'll let you... here, I'm helping you.
Okay. So now Amazon is going to launch lending for Kindle books. Customers will be able to borrow Kindle books from over 11,000 local libraries to read on the Kindle in free Kindle reading apps. Of course, everyone's went high and right on this. And here's the funny thing. Here in Honolulu, this is the big joke in my house. My wife takes the kids to the library. They come home with two or three bags of books, literally two or three bags. My kids are ferocious readers. And so I go online and I pick what I want to read, and it's downloaded for a couple of weeks into the app that I have that I can read these books on. And so, you know, I don't go to the library. Kids do, probably because they don't have an iPad themselves. So, but 11,000 local libraries. So I'm thinking to myself, so does that mean I can check books out from a library in Seattle that I'm not paying any taxes to support? Here's the thing I'm worried about. Okay, this is cool, right? It sounds great. 11,000 local libraries. But as soon as this catches fire, at what point is, and we're already seeing this in communities already with tax cuts, we're already seeing libraries being assaulted. At what point do we start losing libraries nationwide and by the thousands, and everything is that it comes through digitally? There's something about going to a library as a kid and picking up books that you want to read and physically touching them.
Todd, I think it's going to happen either way. I think, I think with with funding cutbacks that are happening at the state, local, and federal level, there's going to be less money for libraries and more pressure to just go get it off the internet. And I think that's unfortunately where this is going. I think where the bigger question that you're raising is, do we need a place for people to go to experience a library type of experience as you move into the future? I mean, younger folks, I know when I was in college, I spent a lot of time in a library
Oh yeah.
It was the social place to hang out in, to study, you know.
Yep.
It does kind of raise the question, is there a place in the future for libraries of what we've known to exist over the last, you know, multi-decades? I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. I'm not sure that there's money there for them to survive. That's
you know,
interesting question.
Go ahead.
I think until we see, I know Google wants to do this, but I think until we see, you know, the digitization, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Of of all the old works and books and things that are important, reference pieces and things. I know I'm a relatively young guy, but I still believe that there is definitely a place for libraries, and I don't see them being eliminated and going away. I see them evolving. You know, I know that our local library here in town, they're very big in the multimedia, you know, educational DVDs, CDs, the audiobooks, things right now for the Nook. So I think you're going to see libraries evolve. Just as we saw them eliminate the card catalog and, you know, changing from the Dewey Decimal System and using other systems and things like that. So I don't think we're going to see them eliminated. I think there's still a great place for them to be for research purposes. People still like to have that central place to do that. I just think we're going to see them evolve and be more technologically advanced, which would be a good thing for our youth and for the future.
I heard that some community college has went completely digital on all their college books. Now, I'll be honest. Here is a $168 statistics book for a statistics class that I'm in right now. Matter of fact, I've got midterms today. I have 2 5-hour tests. Yes, can you believe that? 2 5-hour tests for a midterm. And this sets right here when I'm doing my homework. I don't know if I could go digital on a textbook like this, giving complex statistics equations and problems to work through. If you have two screens, probably. But boy, I don't know. I really don't know if I could make the jump completely to digital. And here I am, I'm a, you know, 40-plus college student. There's not too many of us around, but...
Yeah, Todd, I think you're maybe talking about two different things here. I think a bookstore, I don't think we're going to lose bookstores entirely. I mean, if you're, I know it's the angle that you want to get a paper copy of a book somehow? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, I know we're not apples and oranges. Chase talked about the schools and stuff. I think from a library standpoint, as a young person, I like going in, touching stuff and feeling it. But and from a college perspective, you talked about Rob spending a lot of time in the college because you're doing a lot of research and you have to go get different manuals and pull references out. But your base stuff, and you know, think about, change your mindset and think about going to a college that issues everything digitally. Now, maybe you could do all your research for all your papers digitally. I could see that. But could you do your base book that you need for your class, the book that they make you spend too much money for to buy for your class, could you have used that digitally versus in paper? Could you, today, if you went to college, could you handle that digitally?
You could get most of the way there, I think, with an iPad type of device. I think it's possible.
I think for math stuff, maybe not. But for other classes, probably. I don't know. Maybe I'm just too... all my math books were written in, so they weren't... You couldn't have ever resold them. I know a lot of people don't do that, but for my, you know, sociology classes and that type of stuff, they were all, yeah, you know, I could have turned those back in almost unused.
Yeah, and actually back in the time when I was going to college, we didn't really have personal computers too much back then.
That's true.
So well, it was, I mean, I had to have my term papers typed up for me. I mean,
yep.
That tells you anything.
Well, I guess, and I look at the way my kids are doing things right now. They do all their research for stuff online, and then they use their textbook for the base stuff. So I don't know. I don't know if textbooks are ever going to go completely away or not. We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. So
yeah, I mean, but I think that if you think about these thin slate type of
true
screens that have, you know, a full computer in them that can be used, and maybe, you know, they're touch screens that you can make notes on the pages, just like what I used to do, you know, when I was studying for a final or something like that, I would actually highlight areas of the book and those kind of things, so I could easily go back to. And, you know, if you can apply some of those same kind of
true
concepts about how people use books to a digital experience, I think we can get there and hopefully save a few trees along the way.
And also at the same point too, it's digital, searchable. You know, I'm doing my classes online, so my midterm is open book. You know, and I could even use resources of the internet if I needed to. But so that's why generally online classes are much harder, because they know you have those resources available, so they really sure stick it to you when it comes to the test. And I don't know. I guess we'll see. All right, last couple topics here. Let's talk about Windows. Windows at 18 months. Windows 7 at 18 months. Blog post over at the windowssteamblog.com. Windows 7 has sold more than 350 million licenses. They say that the momentum they continue to see for Windows 7 is incredible, with IE9 getting good growth too. And I have to say, they did a good job in IE9. They've done a pretty nice job with that browser. But they estimate that more than 90% of businesses are currently in progress with their Windows 7 migrations. And they see companies who have deployed Windows 7 save an average of $140 per PC per year, showing 131% return on investment in just 12 months. So looks like where Windows Vista kind of fizzled, Windows Vista was the, you know, once in 10-year thing, like Windows ME was the fizzle. Windows Vista was a fizzle. It looks like Windows 7 they've done pretty good with.
Hi, I wish my company would gladly update my Windows XP laptop that's not even really supposed to have Windows XP on it, because I think Windows 7 is awesome. I think it's great. It's what Vista obviously should have been, but the numbers are not surprising, and we're halfway to Windows 8. So it's phenomenal. It's great. It's solid. It's what it should be. But yeah, please, I work. If you're hearing me, which I know you're not, get me off XP, please. But hey, it's good stuff.
You might be surprised. Sometimes these requests do come around. Rob, what are you hearing in the grapevine? Anything?
Well, I'm really excited for Windows 8. I mean, I think that, you know, what's happening with Windows 7 is that it's growing and being adopted, and people feel really, really good about it. And, you know, I've got all my machines running, you know, on Windows 7. And I think there's a lot of folks out there that have been kind of like saying, you know, well, what is the future of Windows, right? And I have to say that I think that the future of Windows is going to continue to be strong. I mean, I think that there's going to be some erosion, you know, some of these alternative kind of type of computer options that are out there. But I think as you move into Windows 8, I think, you know, it's going to become more competitive in those areas. But I think, you know, I'm really excited to see what creative thing that they're going to come up with Windows 8, because I think from what I keep hearing, they're taking some serious risks with this new operating system and breaking out of the mold that we've all thought about as Windows, and going to take it to the next level. So I'm really excited to see what actually comes out.
It's curious, you know, they're going to that much faster deployment cycle with the operating system. So that's another big thing too. You know, much shorter turnaround.
ARM processor stuff is, I mean, that gives you a little glimpse into what's going to be happening too.
That's true. Well, you know, I've got a mixed bag here. Windows XP, this machine here is Windows 7, this machine here is Windows 7. This one's Windows 7, Mac. laptop is still running Vista. I got two other laptops on Vista, so I got a mixed bag. But I think the only reason these two are XP is because they're my Skype-a-source machines and I don't need anything else. But it is kind of funny to see that interface come up. I'm like, oh my gosh, we lived on that for 10 years or whatever it was. And it's also painful that some people are still stuck on IE6 or something like that too. So corporate stuff doesn't advance very far. Well, guys, we
really, really risky to be on that kind of browser too, from a security standpoint.
Yeah, for sure. Well, guys, we've been at this an hour and 30 minutes. I think the conversation's been pretty good this morning. I want to thank you for hanging out with me. I had some more stuff here, but due to brevity and file size of the encode, I think I'm going to pull the plug here. You know, one thing that I'm just scratching my head about is that I'm always trying to see what other shows are doing. And I looked at someone's 42-minute, 175-meg MP4 in the same window size that I do with a much lower bit rate. And I'm trying to figure out how in the world they got the video quality as good. I need a Windows encoding expert. If anybody's out there as a Windows encoding expert, I need to talk to someone because I really don't understand how some of these shows are getting the quality of video at the lower bit rates that they are as compared to the bit rate that I'm having to set at to get the same quality. I'm completely perplexed on what's going on. And someone's got some secret sauce when it comes to encoding algorithms. I'd pay for that secret sauce. But
well, Todd,
maybe they're using a Mac, Todd.
I have a Mac right here, so it's not, you know, we've tried it on Mac. We've tried on Macs. I don't know what they're doing.
Well, Todd, one thing too is it's quality in, quality out. does apply. I mean, it applies to audio, and I think it does apply to video. So I think the highest quality original that you can make will transcode into better quality on the output side when you start to crunch it too. So
well, maybe I'll try that today, because this file that's being recorded right now will be about 65 gigs in true HD, and it's at like, you know, 55,000 bit rate or something like that. So, you know, maybe I will try this file and see what it crunches down to, just as a I just hate the thought of copying that over.
Yeah. Well, there's also, you know, this whole concept of there's like thresholds that, you know, of bit rate that, you know, a lot of codecs have that, like, you know, to use an example, like a 1 meg kind of bit rate as opposed to a 2 meg bit rate. Really, you can't really tell a big difference between those two in reality.
Well, we're talking about some guys using a 568 bit rate compared to my 2500 bit rate. And I'm like, I can't see the difference, but the file size is obviously massively different. So I got to figure out the secret sauce. Once I do, definitely lower my bandwidth bill. But so maybe that's it. Maybe I need to start with the super superior, super, super high quality encode and see what happens. But Rob, where can they find you?
RobGreenlee.com, ZuneInsider.com, WebTalkRadio.com, on Twitter at Rob Greenlee, and that's GREENLEE. So those are all the main places
and
you can find me.
And Chase?
You could find me on Twitter at Nunes, N-U-N-E-S. Website for our media stuff is GeekGamerRadio.com, and my personal blog and homepage, which hasn't been updated in a few months, is allaboutchase.com. And I just want to say thanks for having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, anytime. And thanks for coming on, guys. And got kids are awake here in the house. It's kind of cool doing the show. It's not cool waking up at 5 a.m. on a Saturday, but I'm done here at 7:30, which is awesome. But for everyone that's watched the show, we want to thank you for hanging out with us. And if you have comments on today's show, you can send them to geeknews@gmail.com. Please preface it with the morning show. That way I can put it in a separate bucket when we follow up. Don't forget to check out The Gadget Professor, a new show here at Geek News Central, show episode number 4. We're really excited about that show. That show is an absolute upward. I'm really amazed at the take up on that show.
It's a really good show. I'm impressed with it too.
Yeah, we're expecting to bust 10K subscribers on this episode. So 4 episodes from 0 to 10K is pretty remarkable. So, but you know, we're kind of leveraging the GNC brand too, and it helps out. But I'm really happy with the growth, and we'll see where this show goes. But anyway, Don Bain is the host over there. Every Thursday it comes out. Check out the past 4 episodes. They're short, so you can watch them real quick. You know, it doesn't take too long. And of course, you can watch my regular show on the website as well, released every Tuesday and Friday. And of course, we'll be back here next Saturday for the Saturday Morning Tech Show. Guys, thanks. We'll see you next time.
All right.
And everyone else, take care. And